Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 14, Perspectives on Insider Trading Post-Newman. David Miller, Amy Greer, and Steve Hansen will discuss current insider trading issues post-Newman. Now, on to the podcast.
This session is called Perspectives on Insider Trading Post-Newman. Newman is a sort of interesting opinion that we'll talk about a little bit. We put that in there to let you know that we're topical. We really could have called this session an insider's view of insider trading. And the reason for that is the three panelists we have here all have spent substantial time working in the government on various sides of issues involving insider trading or more generally material non-public information. Immediately to my right is Amy Greer. Amy has worked for a long time on these issues, and most notably perhaps as the chief trial counsel in the Philadelphia regional office of the SEC. Next to her is David Miller. David has worked on all those cases, or many of them, that you've read about in the headlines. He spent 5 years just before returning to private practice, most recently as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. You all know you're sitting in the Southern District of New York. Before that, he was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. Substantial experience in dealing with insider trading issues from the criminal perspective. My experience is I spent time, well, that sounds bad. I worked in the enforcement division of the SEC down in Washington. I've also had the pleasure of working with many of you. I estimate several dozens of firms on MNPI issues. So hopefully I can do a little report for you on what I see kind of out there from a benchmarking perspective. But we're going to start out with the perspective of how does insider trading look from the perspective of the SEC? So Amy, over to you.
Great. So it will come as no surprise to anyone that insider trading is a key component of the SEC's enforcement program every year. You know, when it reports its key cases, the SEC breaks out its insider trading cases with particular focus and pride, and they do so even though, for example, last year, only 7% of the 755 cases that were brought last year were insider trading cases. But they feel very strongly about insider trading. When the SEC in 2010 developed specialized units in particular areas of focus, market abuse was one of those units. It specializes in insider trading and investigating insider trading as well as other forms of market abuse. And the market abuse unit, the head of the market abuse unit is my former colleague, Dan Hawk. He always likes to say that I was present at the birth of the market abuse unit since we handled a lot of cases out of the Philadelphia regional office even before the unit was formed. And some of those cases were very novel, and it really was an area of focus in the office. The unit uses a combination of sort of old and new techniques to combat insider trading. Sort of on the older traditional side would be FINRA referrals and complaints from SROs, and exchanges, which are collected by the SEC's Office of Market Abuse, blue sheet data, trading data collected during compliance exams, as well as non-public clearing firm data, telephone records, emails, IMs, and data collected during investigations and examinations, both periodic and cause exams, anonymous tips from whistleblowers and from others. You know, the SEC's Insider Trading Hotline whistleblower program, that program predates the current Dodd-Frank whistleblower program about which everyone has been talking about for some time. The insider trading bounty program has been around for a very, very long time. all of this data, all of these kinds of traditional forms of information have now sort of been taken to new heights by the SEC through its big data push. This is something that Chair Mary Jo White and Division Director Andrew Ceresni have been talking about for some time. The SEC has really leveraged all of this data by capturing it and utilizing it and running it through all sorts of complex analytics in order to identify networks of traders, trading patterns, and trends. And they've really used this to assist in their investigation of insider trading.
If I can chime in, this is a really big deal. I mean, we've talked about it earlier in earlier sessions. Historically, back in the dark ages, right, so they would do an insider trading investigation of stock X, and they'd look, and maybe they'd find something, and they wouldn't find something, and then it would go on the shelf. Now you've got X and Y and Z in the computer, right? So looking across time, and as in our, you know, your businesses, this is kind of a qualitative change. It just makes such a difference in what can be seen.
Or more importantly, you go for a standard periodic compliance exam to a big shop, and you're just collecting data. And suddenly, you need to evaluate how groups of traders are trading and whether they're trading in concert. And you already have the data in-house. And so this is really a very significant change. And the result has been that over the last 5 years, the SEC has charged over 600 defendants and in 260 separate insider trading cases. As David will talk about, the collaboration with the Department of Justice has never been more active and more fruitful. In my view, the two agencies work together to make most of the tools that each of them have. You know, the DOJ has things like wiretaps and search warrants. The SEC has the ability to freeze assets in accounts that are believed to hold the proceeds of insider trading, for example, in a much faster way than the Department of Justice can. So the two agencies, I think that the SEC would say that it has people who have a better understanding of the trading laws, the securities laws, an ability to evaluate the trading at a different level than the Department of Justice has. And so using those capabilities, the agencies work together to better defend the markets.
Let's drill down just a little bit. I don't want to steal David's thunder, but this idea of cooperation. In the beginning, right, there were formal referrals from the SEC to criminal authorities, and so there was sort of a process, and it was laborious, and maybe didn't happen all that often. You're saying all the time, right? All the time. So how does it happen? What, do you just wake up in the morning and say, let's give David a call this afternoon, or what? Is there some process wrapped around it?
You know, it varies. I mean, sometimes the DOJ will call you because there's money in an account and they want to make sure it's going to be there when the prosecution goes forward, and because they believe that the SEC can bring something to the table that will be helpful in getting a prosecution moving in a more meaningful way, or that we may have information that will be helpful to the prosecution. And the flip side of that is that, you know, SEC cases, particularly in the insider trading area, are largely based on circumstantial evidence. You have the trading data, but given the nature of the elements, what was the intention of the person that was trading? Where did they get the information? How was the information exchanged? Sometimes it's hard to get under those things. And so search warrants, wiretaps, that sort of thing, are much more useful. And contacting the Department of Justice to get their assistance in helping to investigate, you know, what happened here is why we would contact the Department of Justice. In addition, in particularly egregious cases, you know, the SEC only has civil enforcement authority. And frankly, in particularly egregious cases, the SEC thinks these people belong in jail.
And if I may, just to chime in, and I'll talk more about this later. The one thing that hasn't really been discussed or hit on is the value of what we in the business called cooperators. And particularly in insider trading cases, cooperators are key. And sometimes these cases actually don't even originate with algorithms and big data and et cetera, blue sheet data. They actually originate with people who are either concerned about what's going on at their respective funds, or they think that the FBI, and maybe for good reason, is on to their illegal activity. And so they decide to contact through their attorneys, the prosecutors or the FBI agents, and they come in to what we call proffer. Sometimes the cases actually do originate with DOJ, and then oftentimes, as Amy points out, there are strengths that each agency has, and oftentimes the department will get the SEC involved in those kinds of cases. But as I'll talk about more in terms of the coordination, cooperators, whistleblowers, those will be key for criminal cases.
So Amy, you've suggested that if you maybe need extra oomph to do a wiretap as a reason, the SEC would communicate with David, not to personalize this. Maybe it's a particularly egregious case. Are there other criteria that the SEC uses, or is it more free form than that?
Oh, I think it's probably more free form than that. I mean, I think that agencies cooperate on a variety of types of cases. It's not just insider trading cases. In fact, there are a lot of different types of enforcement matters that the SEC and the DOJ will cooperate on and collaborate on. But I do think that it's a facts and circumstances situation.
Okay, but let's reassure the audience. It's not every case, right?
Oh, no. I mean,
okay, good.
I have to say, it's really changed significantly. I left the SEC in 2008, and there were a lot of cases where you basically have to beg them to get involved. So it's not, it's certainly not every case. It's certainly not every case. You know, this is a pretty sophisticated audience, but we sort of feel like we have to do kind of baseline insider trading 101 to have a really good conversation. I'll try to keep it short. As probably everyone in this room knows, here in the United States, there is not a statute that outlaws insider trading per se. Rather, the law is, the insider trading is charged under the anti-fraud provisions of the securities laws. And to make that charge requires a showing of some deceptive conduct or breach of duty. Over the years, both the courts and the SEC have engaged in some pretty significant legal gymnastics in order to have facts and circumstances fit within those statutes. And some of the decisional authority shows those contortions. Insider trading generally occurs when a security is bought or sold in breach of a fiduciary duty or other relationship of trust or confidence while in possession of material non-public information. Under the classical theory of insider trading, someone with a direct relationship to the company whose security is traded, so a director, officer, employee, or a temporary insider, like an outside lawyer or accountant doing work for the company, breaches his or her duty to the company by trading while in possession of the company's material non-public information. Under the misappropriation theory, the trader is someone who acquires that and misuses that material non-public information, but that information has been entrusted to someone else, and the misappropriator takes that information and breaches the duty to that person as opposed to the company. So David and I are really good friends. David works at the company. David tells me that the company is about to engage in a merger. He says, it's confidential, don't say anything to anybody. And I say, sure. And then I go trade on it. I've misappropriated the information from David. And that would be chargeable under the insider trading laws. As I've noted, in each instance, you have to trade on material non-public information. And in a lot of cases, what's material, what's non-public, this gets into, you know, let's just say trouble ensues. We're not going to go into that so much here today, but take my word for it. Because of the fact that insider trading law is really complicated, over the years, the SEC has found sort of other ways of charging this kind of conduct. There is a statute, Section 14E of the Securities Exchange Act, and Rule 14E3A, which is a rule under Section 14E. The SEC can charge trading on material non-public information in advance of a tender offer, so it's particular to the tender offer circumstance, without any showing of a breach of trust. And so that's a simpler way of going about it, and needless to say, they sort of like that better. In addition, in circumstances where there is no breach of relationship of trust and confidence, but where information has been stolen, where someone has taken someone's briefcase, meaning to steal the briefcase, and inside is the merger information and they trade on it, and that's what they intended to do. They knew that that guy was the CEO and expected to find good secrets in there, whether it was the quarterly earnings report, and instead they really hit the jackpot. Those cases known as non-fiduciary thief cases, the agency has successfully charged those cases just under the straight anti-fraud provisions. I will say that's a fairly recent change. For many years, the agency charged cases like that, even though there was no duty of trust and confidence, as insider trading. And frankly, the courts went along with it. And I think it was largely because these were bad people and they needed to be taken to task for their bad conduct. But fairly recently, the commission decided, with some prodding from those of us in the Philadelphia regional office, that the non-fiduciary thief cases, where possible, should be charged as straight 10B cases where there was a manipulative device. And so there was a line of cases out of the Second Circuit, and you are also sitting in the Second Circuit, first the Oliver Peak case and then the Dorosko case, where information was stolen. The Peak case you may have read about. Mr. Peak was an Estonian trader who hacked into Business Wire using a computer bot, and he traded on information in the Business Wire press releases before they were released. And he made a lot of money. And we froze those accounts, and then the question was, how do we charge this? It was pretty novel conduct. And so there was a lot of discussion at the SEC. People wanted to charge that as insider trading, and instead we convinced them to charge it as what we thought it should be, and there is now a whole line of cases charging it differently. So frankly, after Newman, which is of course the main event here today, there's been some talk about new statutes and passing laws to change insider trading law, but it's cases like the Peak and Dorosko case that stand for the proposition that the SEC is much happier without a statute, because you can always change the law decisionally to fit new conduct, because fraudsters are pretty...
One could be cynical about that view. Not that I would suggest that anybody in this room would be cynical about the view that the SEC intentionally keeps things vague and uncertain for us, Amy. We won't hold you personally responsible for that.
I defend people for a living. They intentionally keep things vague.
Yeah.
They do. There's just no question about it. So,
Are you going to give us an overview of the kind of the penalties and the relief that the SEC seeks? And I'm particularly interested, and I think this audience may be, Amy, about how about innocent players like funds? Are they at risk in insider trading cases?
Well, they are. I mean, so generally speaking, the SEC will get a disgorgement from the wrongdoer and then a penalty somewhere usually between 1 and 3 times the amount of the disgorgement. Often in these cases, to the extent that the ill-gotten gains are being held by someone who is not actually a wrongdoer, that individual or entity, whether it's someone's spouse or mother or a fund, will be named as a relief defendant.
You are tough. Someone's mother? You take the money from somebody's mother?
I've done it.
Oh, my.
Sorry.
But in any event, that same logic can apply to a managed fund as well.
Correct. They're not charged as a wrongdoer, and that's clear. It's just the place that the money resides.
It's like bank error in your favor. You have to give it back.
Something like that.
Oh.
I mean, it's charging the holder of the money as the holder of the money, and the complaint is generally drafted as such. So going on to this tipping issue. So in addition to those with direct relationships and those who are misappropriators of people's material non-public information, those who convey the material non-public information to third parties can be held liable for tipping that information, communicating that non-public information to another for the purpose of trading. both the tipper and the tippee can be held liable if all of the elements are met. And recently, in this Newman case that we've been talking about, there have been some changes to the law of tipping. For a tipper to be liable, he or she has to disclose the material non-public information in breach of a duty owed either to the company or to the person from whom the information was misappropriated. And the tipper has to know that she's breached that duty, and the tipper has to receive a personal benefit in exchange for that disclosure. They have to get something of value in exchange. Now, over time, prior to Newman, the law of tipping and tippees, and specifically the definition of benefit, especially between so-called friends, had become so broad as to become, in my view, almost undefinable. Really, every acquaintance became a friend, and the purported friendship, no matter how tenuous, could support and be sufficient enough to meet the benefit requirement. And if you look at the case law, you'll see that. And I've had this conversation now in my current role with, you know, staffers at the SEC and said to them, well, you know, you and I have worked at the SEC at the same time. I've never met you before this case, but under your theory, you and I could be friends because we worked at the same organization at the same time. And in fact, that level of friendship had become sufficient.
And to close the link, the notion was that the friendship was the reason you were giving me the information.
Correct.
I wish it had been better information, but okay.
Sorry.
And so that was the wrongfulness, if you will.
Exactly. So now Newman has sort of brought all of this back to earth in that previously remote tippies, even with this very broad idea of friendship, could be held liable even if they had no idea about the initial and immediate breaches of duty and even with this very nebulous idea of what a benefit was. Now, after Newman, tippee liability derives only from the tipper's breach of duty and not merely from the fact that some trading happened. And the tipper has to actually have breached a duty and has to have received something of benefit for the disclosure, and that benefit has to be tangible. You know, it has to be objective, consequential, pecuniary in value. The friendship has to be meaningfully close, and there's a knowledge element. The tipper can only be held liable, and this is including remote tippies, you know, he tells me, I tell him, only if the tippee knew or should have known about the breach of duty.
And this is worth pausing on, I think, because every one of us has analysts that go out there and try to collect information, and sometimes information sources are unknown or not fully known. And the question of whether the information is coming from someplace where there's a duty not to transmit that information is determinative of whether you can go ahead and trade or not. So this is potentially a very big deal if we could only quite figure out what it means. But I guess Amy's telling us that you have to be close friends now, not just friends. Go figure that one out.
Not just friends.
Not just friends. So, yeah, those of us who sometimes are called upon to help you all decide whether you can trade sit there and say, okay, were they close friends or merely friends? Were they semi-close friends? I don't know where this discussion goes, but maybe it's time to move to criminal stuff. Okay, let's hear from the criminal guys.
Well, look, I was going to talk about this later, but let me just pick up on it right now, and then I'll loop back onto how this all began. Look, ultimately, with respect to Newman and the impact, whether it's globally or in criminal cases or civil cases, is really two points to remember, because there's a lot of gobbledygook in the Second Circuit's opinion. Number one, that remote tippees, people down the line, they have to know about the fact that the initial tipper got a personal benefit. What does that mean in practice? It means that the Department of Justice and the SEC, even though the SEC has a lower burden, preponderance of the evidence, and Department of Justice beyond a reasonable doubt, are going to bring a lot less of these cases because they're going to have to prove that the remote tippee knew about the personal benefit. Second, the Second Circuit went even further, because that was the question presented, by the way, on appeal. But the Second Circuit went further and said, also, by the way, this whole personal benefit thing, mere friendship, whatever that is, as Amy pointed out, is not enough. And it needs to be something of consequential, pecuniary, something of value. That also, you know, and there are practitioners who argue about this, that was kind of a departure. I mean, there was a case in the Second Circuit called SEC v. Obis that basically talked about how mere friendship was enough. You know, there was the Winifred Zhao case, which the Newman case cited to quite a bit, which actually I argued for the government on appeal on. And the circuit was pretty open to the idea that mere friendship was enough. Now, in that case, there was a lot more in terms of the potential pecuniary value as a personal benefit, so it's not really an issue for that case. But the circuit cited to it and talked about that case when, at argument in that case, the panel was basically saying personal benefits, mere friendship. So clearly there has been a departure on that second point that the circuit wasn't asked to consider, and now has said personal benefit is something of consequential pecuniary value. What does this mean for you guys? What does this mean for your clients? As a practical matter, and what I've told people is, look, this decision is complex. Folks are not quite sure what it means, because now this, what does it mean for something to be of consequence, of potential pecuniary nature, a substantial friendship, all the buzzwords from this opinion. Bottom line is this, and what I tell clients, maintain the same level of rigor and the same compliance program that you had before December of 2014 when this opinion came down. It's too dangerous to try to assume that now you can skirt the enforcement authorities because it's harder for them to bring these insider trading cases. But now let me loop back to how this all began, because there's really two points to why I'm going to speak right now. Number one, more importantly, you're going to get ethics credit. Number two, I'm going to tell you how the government prosecutes these cases, and most importantly, how to avoid the investigations and the prosecutions. This started from the Department of Justice's standpoint around 2007, 2008, which is now all public, that for the first time, my old unit, the Securities Unit of Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office, decided to use what's called Title III of the Omnibus Crime and Control Act of 1968, wiretaps, to go up against insider traders, many of whom at that point were at hedge funds. Those wiretaps yielded a treasure trove of evidence in criminal investigations, prosecutions, and ultimately trials. Obviously, everybody knows about Galleon. Galleon was the first major domino to fall, and that investigation was the key investigation that spawned a lot of additional targets and investigations and ultimate prosecutions. Of course, the first major case that everybody knows about and major arrest in the fall of 2009 was of Raj Rajaratnam, who was the head of Galleon. He ultimately went to trial, was convicted, and is serving 11 years imprisonment. The investigations through wiretaps and through cooperators spawned into a number of other important cases, including obviously SAC Capital, which was not only ultimately resulted in a guilty plea of the actual fund, but also several individuals at SAC and at other places that were working with folks at SAC to commit insider trading. Also, you have the Southern District's dragnet against expert networking firms. And I'm mentioning cases that obviously are familiar to me and cases that I was involved in and prosecuted. Expert networking firms in particular, I've always heard from clients as a key concern today because of the potential for abuse, and also obviously because of the fact that the U.S. Attorney's Office, Department of Justice, and the SEC have been focused like a laser, if you will, on expert networking firms. There's nothing illegal about an expert networking firm. What happened, however, with cases like James Fleischman and Winifred Zhao, Tai Nguyen, these were situations where you had consultants who were consulting for the expert networking firms, and the expert networking firm put the consultants together with the hedge funds, which is perfectly fine and legal, except for when the consultants decided in these particular cases to tip MNPI to the hedge funds. So because the consultants, once they put the folks in touch with each other, are pretty much out of the equation, there has been a potential for abuse. And that's why funds have been focused on this, and they should be, in trying to make sure that they have oversight in what their traders are doing, particularly with expert networking firms.
David, should we stop or just pause here for a second? The whole expert network thing, if you will, If we think about an analyst going out and getting information by interviewing people versus going out and paying someone for the information, we remember the discussion we just had about personal benefit? Well, there's no doubt that if I'm paying somebody for the information, there's personal benefit, right? There's no, that debate is over, and David's got a clear case on that point. So analytically, it sounds similar to what we think of traditional analysts doing, but it has this additional element of the payment, which can, depending on what the information is and the circumstances, make all the difference.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And again, with these kinds of cases, whether it's expert networking firms and cases that I was involved in prosecuting, or SAC or Gallium-related cases that I was involved in prosecuting, we never had, frankly, a close call on personal benefit, even pre-Newman, because these cases all involved payment of money to the insider, and even at every step of the chain. And ultimately, and obviously also there were misappropriation cases, and Amy talked about what misappropriation cases are, which are becoming an increasing focus over the last couple of years of prosecuting folks, both criminally and civilly, for breaching a duty to the source of the information. And there's a number of cases like that, particularly in the last couple of years. But the important takeaway of all this, and what I'll call the SDNY dragnet from 2009 to 2014, is that you had an extremely dispersed, wide-ranging system of investigations and prosecutions that resulted in significant jail time for many defendants. These cases have massive consequences for those who are engaged in the illegal activity, their families, and even their funds. And as everyone in this room is well aware, all it takes is a serious allegation to make it, or an even not so serious allegation, to make it into the press about insider trading taking place at a fund, and that fund's business can be in jeopardy. And there have been several funds that have gone down because of just that. So let me also mention the coordination and cooperation aspect to this, and then I'll talk about investigations and frankly how to avoid them. Since 2008-ish, 2009-ish, when this so-called dragnet started, there has been increased cooperation between the Department of Justice and the SEC on insider trading matters, and obviously also with any kind of securities or commodities fraud matter between DOJ, SEC, CFTC, and FINRA. When I was prosecuting securities and commodities fraud cases at Southern District, almost every single day, I was either on the phone or in a meeting with somebody either from the SEC, the CFTC, or FINRA. You should assume that whenever there is any kind of investigation, God forbid, of you or your clients, and it's not relating to something like broken gate or broken windows, but something that maybe has a larger semblance of wrongdoing, that there is a good chance that all the enforcement authorities are talking to each other. You should never assume that, okay, I'll just deal with the SEC and it'll just be civil, and so I won't need to tell them about X, Y, and Z because that would maybe get me in trouble with the criminal authorities. Assume that the lines of communication are open, and that is important because it shows your level of credibility when you're dealing with the enforcement attorneys, not because you know that they are talking, but because you have the courtesy of telling them about X, Y, and Z, so those people don't hear it from the other agency, which they don't like to do. You know, every day there's information and data flow and meetings. There's phone calls all the time between the agencies. The one thing that doesn't get shared is grand jury material under Federal Rule Procedure 6E and wiretap information. Those two things don't go to other agencies. Frankly, within the Department of Justice, they can't go from criminal authorities to civil authorities. So when I was in AUSA in the criminal division here in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I couldn't share grand jury information or wiretap information with the civil AUSAs of my same office. So how do these investigations begin? Why do they begin? And what kind of techniques are used by the FBI and the Department of Justice? As Amy mentioned, there's a lot of information flow, and a lot of the data, for example, comes from the SEC or FINRA to the DOJ. But as I mentioned, sometimes these investigations start from people as opposed to data. And so ultimately, what the criminal authorities are looking at in the insider trading area are things like trade allocations, trade timing, undisclosed conflicts of interest, valuation of assets, misrepresentations of portfolio performance, evasion of limitations on investor qualifications, use of expert networks. Those are the kinds of things that they're looking at from an overall securities fraud perspective that many times may lead to insider trading investigations and prosecutions. And I'll also note this in terms of cooperation. The FBI has agents who are what's called embedded with the Securities and Exchange Commission. So in the New York Regional Office, for example, there are some FBI agents from one of the three FBI squads in this town that do securities fraud work, have agents sitting right there with the market abuse unit. So what the market abuse unit learns, they learn. The Department of Justice, and they're one of DOJ's many strengths, is the ability to what's called flip people, get people to become cooperators, to work with the FBI, to work with the prosecutors in developing an investigation and prosecution. The ability of the government to do that is enhanced because of cooperation sharing of things like the FBI sitting with the market abuse unit. So the prosecutors know from a trading perspective, a timing perspective, what's going on, and can use that information to flip people against other folks at the fund, at the banks, at the broker-dealers, wherever the wrongdoing is occurring. Obviously, also, the DOJ can issue grand jury subpoenas, wiretaps, search warrants. These are all investigative techniques that the government is going to use as part of an investigation to develop a case, whether it's against an individual or against an entity. So, how do you potentially avoid investigations?
Before you go there, and let me just say at a much simpler level than wiretaps and grand jury subpoenas, particularly for funds that are now registered, because that's an additional level of entree for the SEC. The SEC just believes that if your performance is really, really good, that you're cheating. They just believe that. They will undertake to do an exam. Now, whether they call it a periodic exam that they have because you haven't been reviewed before. Frankly, if you haven't been reviewed before, that's likely what they'll do. But the exam staff will sit down with the enforcement staff and talk about what sorts of things should we be looking for at this hedge fund that we've never examined before. Because, gosh, they have really great performance. And they'll collect all of this information, and you know they have the right to do that. It's a lot less intrusive, but it's a starting place. And it's completely within their rights to do that. And now that the exam staff is very enforcement heavy at the top, and now that the exam staff is often manned or womaned with enforcement lawyers going out on exams, this is a very simple, painless, at least for most involved, to get a lot of information about your fund, about your performance, and about how you got to there, to look into potential insider trading.
I don't know about the painless part, but we certainly see it happen.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's certainly less painless than having a search warrant executed at your door.
There's a lot of things that are more fun than that, though.
Yeah, and to that point, it is never too early to get off on the right foot with the enforcement authorities. And that could be before an investigation is commenced. And how? So how do you avoid it? Now, I should have mentioned this before. A lot of what we're talking about, incidentally, is discussed and laid out in a detailed handout that's in the book. And we go through a lot of these points. But now let me go through how do you avoid a potential insider trading investigation. Compliance professionals. I know that sounds obviously very basic and rudimentary, but there are, you know, funds and firms that don't have compliance professionals. And like Amy said, some of the enforcement folks are looking to make a case. And so they might, you know, start off on a foot.
They all are.
Yeah, I'm trying to be nice. Looking to make a case. And so before, you know, an investigation starts, if they see from an exam or they hear from a cooperator who's working on another case, there are no compliance folks there. There's not a culture of compliance, which is essential. There's no clear lines of authority in reporting up problems to compliance professionals or in-house counsel. That is going to get you off on the wrong foot. And you're dealing with human beings, and perception is everything. And so you want to start from the beginning with a clear line of responsibility, a line of communication that it is present in your firm, in your fund, so that the enforcement authorities think, okay, they're trying to do the right thing. Obviously, written manuals, education, training of your employees and traders, these are key things. I know these sound like rudimentary things, but some folks don't do it. It really you get off on the wrong foot in trying to avoid a potential insider trading investigation, or if one starts, from nipping it in the bud to convince the enforcement authorities this is a one-off thing, this is not what's happening, and it's not a pervasive problem at our fund. And to that extent, things like restricted stock lists, being careful and instructing folks at the fund about expert networks, carefully monitoring trades and calls, and potentially even Bloomberg IMs, making sure that people understand a pre-clearance process, and finally, monitoring any consultants or experts that are used by the fund. These are our key points that will get you off on the right foot. What happens, however, if an investigation is commenced? The one thing I will say is you all want to stay ahead of any investigation. Don't think just because it's the Department of Justice or the SEC that they are omniscient and they know exactly what happened and what's going on at your fund or firm. Believe me, I may have uttered those words when I was on the other side, and sometimes that is the case, but that is not always the case. So you can have the ability to stay ahead of an investigation, to proactively and have, you know, your outside counsel, or if you're just doing in-house counsel, proactively framing the facts for the Department of Justice that is conducting the investigation, responding to subpoenas cooperatively, trying to narrow them, issuing litigation hold memos early. These are all important things to do at inception, from the beginning of an investigation, to try to avoid having people get called in for a proffer session or grand jury testimony. And there are major advantages to working with the government in trying to be cooperative. It may prevent the government and the FBI from engaging in covert contact with employees. You can try to decipher the government's intention. You earn credit from your cooperation and your ability to cooperate in an engagement, one-on-one, personal, human being kind of interaction can go a long way in building trust, credibility, and rapport with the government, and can avoid the government taking more intrusive methods like executing a search warrant, which can spell death for a business. And it's just, as soon as the press gets a hold of that, your investors will get panicked. So with that, I'll just say quickly what's coming down the pike in the next minute. Traditional insider trading, probably less of that in terms of what's being prosecuted by the Department of Justice because of an uncertain future post-Newman. Misappropriation cases, same thing. Political intelligence, which you may have heard about, that is a significant issue and is something that both the DOJ and the SEC are looking at from an insider trading platform. And then whether it's insider trading or other securities fraud, whether it be accounting fraud or market manipulation, spoofing you heard a little bit about earlier, high frequency trading, Bank Secrecy Act, FCPA, these are issues that are still going to continue. And while insider trading may have been more of a priority over some of these issues, or seemingly so from a press perspective in recent years, post-Newman, it's unlikely to be taking that front and center position. But the postscript to that is, don't let off on your compliance efforts. Maintain the same level of vigor because the enforcement authorities are out there.
Well, and I'm going to take his 15 seconds by saying it's not going to change at the SEC. I don't really think Newman is going to change a thing at the SEC.
There's different burdens of proof. Yeah,
but
I should imagine.
But more importantly, I don't think that they view it as a hindrance. And the fact is that basic insider trading, people getting information, people stealing information, or people taking, you know, classical insider trading, misappropriation theory, insider trading, this remote tippy stuff, there's a whole world of just regular, plain vanilla insider trading for the SEC to charge.
If we do this conference 10 years from now, we'll be talking to you about insider trading being a priority of the SEC.
Correct.
And since it, in the criminal world it goes in waves, it, the wave will probably be back by then.
I think that's right.
Okay.
That's probably right.
So yeah, the more it goes around, comes around, yeah. And you don't have to look too far back in the past to see that, the Boesky era and so on. Okay, to the extent that we have time left, I'm supposed to reflect on this sort of from your perspective or what we're seeing when we're out working with you all, kind of what's going on across the industry. 2 points to start with, I think. One is you all know that you're required to have policies and procedures. David's told you you have to have them for all sorts of reasons to prevent the problems, but you're also affirmatively required by law to have them. Investment advisors and broker-dealers, unlike the rest of the world, are required to have insider trading procedures. You just got to do it. Okay, we've all known that. That's not news. The other thing that you need to keep in mind, and I know you do all have in mind, is there are theories of liability out there that are less dramatic than these fraud theories that we're talking about or that can go up the chain. You all may remember that Steve Cohen, the SEC brought a proceeding against him on a, quote, failure to supervise theory. That is, management in a firm, including sometimes compliance personnel, can be responsible for supervision of the personnel. And if there are underlying violations, then that can travel up and be the responsibility of individuals who have supervisory responsibility. With those two thoughts in mind, everybody in the room has a policy statement about insider trading. We've all gotten that message. And it generally has this prohibition on insider trading, and that's all well and good. What we do see, and what you may want to look for when you get back to your office and recover from today, is are you addressing those things that you want to address? And in particular, are you creating duties? We talked here about how there can be various obligations and duties that can be created by your own rules. Have you done that? Have you done that in a way that you intend? Or do you have some unintended consequences? Concrete example, I was looking at the manual of a firm recently that had a prohibition on personnel talking to analysts and personnel at other managers. Now, do I think that happened nevertheless? Of course it did, because people would bounce ideas off one another and the like. Could that give rise to the notion that someone was providing information in violation of a duty? I bet you David would say it could. Amy probably would say it could. So you want to make sure that what you have in your manual is what you intend it to be, and that if you're creating duties, they're duties that you want to create.
But also that when you have these policies, that when you create these responsibilities, that if you did intend them, that you document that people are following them.
It's a very good idea if you have a policy or procedure to follow it, because it's so easy for Amy's former colleagues.
No, I'm serious. Right? They believe if you haven't documented it, that it didn't happen. And so to the extent that you get into trouble, that's going to be the first question is, where's the documentation that people got this training, that people reviewed your policies, that this policy of not talking with those folks was implemented, that people understood it, that people followed it. Just having the policy by itself is not useful.
It's only the starting point, I guess, is the way to think about it. And we all know that viscerally, right? Because we've lived through exams and we know the examiners come in and ask us what we're actually doing. What we put up on the screen now are some of the areas where, to varying degrees, we are now seeing policies and procedures. That is, some of your compatriots at some firms, not everywhere, have policies that are directly aimed at monitoring use of expert networks. And that, of course, became a very good idea. I forget what morning it was in 2008, but it became a very good idea at some point. You know, a lot of firms have moved in that direction. Now, there are various elements that can be in such a policy, and we see a variety of different elements. We see firms that have a requirement that there be some kind of reminder at the time of a communication that the firm is in the management business, is not looking to receive material non-public information. And there can be some cynicism about this. I've actually heard some members of law enforcement say, well, gee, it just becomes rote. And of course it can, of course it can. But it's also a little tripwire to remind our folks that we're serious about this. And so we see that with, I'd say, pretty general policy for those folks that have adopted a policy with respect to expert networks. We also see elements of diligence processes to check out the actual consultant, not just the intermediary who's providing the consultant, to learn about that consultant and get a comfort level there. And then the third thing that we see in varying degrees is some follow-up look to see whether trades that may have been driven by information turn out to be too good to be true. The extraordinary performance point that Amy was making earlier. So integrating that into sort of the trading look-backs. And those elements are what we're seeing out there, I'd say, with reasonably frequently. Not everybody, not all the time. There clearly are judgments to be made about how you use expert networks. A lot of the use may be not particularly dangerous or potentially problematic, but you need to know what you're doing. Some firms will actually chaperone conversations. We don't see that universally by any means. As David mentioned, kind of on the horizon, the question of political intelligence. It's important in some areas, unimportant to some of you. It's a species of expert networks. It's essentially trying to get information about what's going on in the political sphere. The issues there are even more complicated than the ones we've alluded to, but we're starting to see policies and procedures that are specifically targeted there, driven by some of the events we've all read about. It's very common these days for the SEC examiners to ask you if your analysts go out, if your PMs go out, and have meetings with management. Are they small group meetings? Are they one-on-one? Do you know when they happened? Do you know what happened? And the like. And so some folks have started to try to wrap some process around that. Not necessarily preventing it, but understanding when it occurs and being able to monitor it. That's been traditionally, of course, a process that we all go through to try to learn what we can about firms appropriately. You can see how it can cross over and create a problem, hence the need or the thought to have some process and procedure associated with it. I won't go into the other items in the same depth, but each of those areas are ones where if they affect your firm, if you're doing pipes, if you're involved with distressed instruments in the bankruptcy world, if you've got people who serve on boards, either your personnel or people who serve at your behest, and of course, our old favorite, if you enter into NDAs, all of those circumstances can be ones that give rise to the kinds of duties that we've talked about here and create potential headaches if we obtain information that's inconsistent with that, and therefore are places to think about adopting policies and procedures. And my favorite point, train, 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 because what you really want is your people, of course, to be as sensitive to these issues as you all are, so they come to you at an early point so you can make a purposeful institutional decision about whether you can trade under the circumstances or not trade. The last thing that I should refer to that's on our list there is the need to be aware of what the laws are in other jurisdictions if you're trading in other jurisdictions. Amy told us about Rule 14E3, which says, essentially, with tender offers, we don't have to have this discussion about duties. If you have material non-public information about a tender offer that came either from the person about to make the tender offer or the target of the tender offer, and I don't know where else information could come from, but if it comes from those sources, you're prohibited from trading. Similar kinds of rules exist in some of the jurisdictions in which some of you trade. And I'm not here to talk about English law because we heard about that earlier, though not this aspect, but it's different. It's different than this kind of duty analysis that we're talking about. So those of you that are trading overseas need to be familiar with that and have the same kind of thought process and policies and training around that. Now, thank you for being here at the end. We really appreciate your sticking with us. Thanks.
And thanks for spending the day with us.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.